So, hello everyone. My name's Saria Gupta, and I'm going to be continuing our seminar that we've been having the last few weeks. If you've been here, Jnana Varcha has been taking us through themes that arise from the Sevenfold Puja, which is one of the practices we do here at the centre. So, I'm going to sort of continue that, but I also thought, because we're halfway through the seminar, he started at the beginning of January, I thought we'd sort of take a bit of a pause as well and sort of step back and look at the puja as a whole, and then I'll take us forward into the next theme, or at least introduce the next theme, and we'll be picking it up next week as well. So, a recap really of the Sevenfold Puja, but I actually, when I thought of thinking I was going to recap, I thought I went all the way back to the beginnings of the puja. So this puja that we, how many of you have actually done the Sevenfold Puja? Okay, actually quite a lot of you, that's great. So puja, for those of you who haven't done it, means worship, and it's a collective devotional practice that we do. And it was the puja that we do was compiled by Sangharakshita from an ancient text called the Bodhicharya Vatara. And I've got a copy of the text here. I've got two copies. This is my sort of well-thumbed copy. Got me through a lot of challenges, that. And this is the one that's selling in the bookshop now. So Sangharakshita, the founder of this centre, compiled the puja from this text that comes from the 8th century. And it's called the Bodhicharya Vatara, which means the Bodhisattva's way of life. So a Bodhisattva is someone who is intent, or whose will is directed towards enlightenment, not for their own sake, for their sake and for the benefit of all beings. So it's someone whose will, whose intent is directed, whose all their energy, if you like, is focused on enlightenment for their own sake and for the benefit of all beings. So if you've been around for a while, you'll have heard that being said. This is what a bodhisattva is. But I kind of think, well, it takes actually a real imaginative leap to even sort of think about what that actually means, yeah? That you're practicing intently, all your energies are focused on enlightenment. So I kind of thought that would mean that you sort of wake up in the morning and you'd have a very, all your orientation, all your energy was focused on growth. And you are very aware that any positive action that you made would benefit everybody. And any negative action or any unskillful action you engaged in would harm everyone. So it's quite a different, it's a radically different way of being. I certainly don't wake up thinking that. And actually not only waking up, that would permeate and pervade your whole experience. So every interaction you had, you'd be very aware of your sort of interconnection with that person, your interdependence with that person. So your sensibility, your sensitivity to another would be, well, in a way there wouldn't be any, you wouldn't experience really any separation between you and others. What harms another, you would feel that pain, and what causes somebody to be joyful, you'd also feel that joy. So a radically different orientation. So this puja that we do is an introduction, if you like, or gives us a glimpse into the mind of a bodhisattva, a mind that thinks and operates and orientates that way. So yes, it was written in the 8th century by a monk called Shantideva, and he was clearly a bodhisattva, practicing for himself and all beings. And I was thinking about his story today. So he, as a youth, he was a prince, so he came from a very well-to-do sort of background. And as a prince, one day he met a yogi, he met a teacher, a wandering teacher, who gave him a practice to do. I was thinking that doesn't really happen these days, is it? That you just walk along and somebody gives you a meditation practice to try out. But this is what happened to Shantideva. And this practice was of an archetypal figure called Manjushri. So Vajramati spoke about archetypal figures earlier, and we have some on the shrine today. And in Tri Ratna, we do a number of practices, as you know. We do the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana that you've all done. Many of you have done the puja, which is great. You've all chanted mantras, therefore, as well. So you've actually had an introduction via the mantras to these archetypal figures. When you're ordained, you get given a sadhana practice, which is a visualization practice, where you're basically conjuring up daily a figure. And these figures represent a quality, an aspect of the enlightened mind. So what you're really doing, as you sort of reflect and you visualize these figures every day, you're really getting a much more sort of tangible experience of what that quality would be like for you. Because you're sort of conjuring up the figure and getting almost imbibing somehow that quality. At least you're getting familiar with that quality and imagining what that would be like for you. So that's what these sadhana practices do, these visualization practices. And we've all been doing mantras, so we did one earlier. And in a way, the mantra is this sort of essence of that quality. And as we were doing that mantra earlier, every mantra sort of evokes a different feeling. I don't know if you've experienced that, but some mantras are really soothing. That one we did earlier was just very soothing, very relaxing. And other mantras really get your energies sort of going. So every mantra gives you a different sort of aspect of that sort of that figure, the essence of that quality. So we do these practices. Anyway, Shantideva was given this practice, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And Manjushri holds this sort of flame a flaming sword aloft, and also holds a sort of precious text to his heart as well. So yes, on the shrine today we have Amitabha. We have two versions, as we said earlier. We have the meditating Amitabha, and we have the Amitabha here, this relief. He's holding aloft a flower. And the Amitabha practice sort of represents love and infinite light. And when you, the visualization of Amitabha, you visualize Amitabha, there's a sea and there's a setting sun. So the sun is setting into the sea, and a lotus appears in the sky, and Amitabha is there, sort of radiating this red. And red in itself is a very attractive colour. So if you imagine the setting sun, which is deeply sort of relaxing and soothing, and then you have this red, you're sort of attracted to this red, and it has a very strong sort of heart-opening effect doing this practice. So that's who's on the shrine today, Amitabha. And for me, when I sort of practice, or when I chant the mantra, I definitely have that same sort of soothing, almost reassuring. It almost has a reassuring quality, Amitabha, and definitely relaxing in a way. Relaxing, I would say, the sort of any hard edges of my mind or heart. It's sort of softening me up to be sort of open, receptive to how things are. So anyway, back to Shantideva. I'm going to weave in and out of Shantideva's story. So he was given this practice, and he was there. And every practice, just like the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana, you have the stages of the practice. You have the things you've got to do, the next stage, and the various instructions. So Shantideva would have had a practice like this. And so there he is practicing, and then all of a sudden, he's no longer practicing. He's no longer consciously imagining Manjushri. Manjushri has made an appearance. It's as if Manjushri has come, has just come alive on some level. So that sounds, I don't know what it sounds like to you, but it sounds odd, mysterious. What does that mean? for something to come alive? What does it mean? You're practicing away, and then suddenly it's no longer a practice. It feels as if it's real. So I was thinking about the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana, and because it can sound very mysterious, but actually it's not a million miles away either, that experience, because if, particularly if you've been on retreat, you may have had the experience where you're doing the mindfulness of breathing and you're counting the your breaths and you're getting distracted and you're bringing, somebody says bring yourself back, so you bring yourself back, and then the bell goes and you're thinking, okay, what next? You know, the sort of stuff that goes on in the mind, yeah, and you get distracted again, all of that. It's a very sort of ordinary experience, our sort of regular experience often of our mind. Same with metta bhavana, you're sort of visualising somebody comes into mind, and you know, you sort of think, oh, you have your reactions to them, you have your responses to them, you try a bit harder to kind of get engaged, you get a bit bored, you know, all those things come happen with the metta bhavana as well. But then every now and again, your mind settles, and suddenly, and it can feel like a sudden thing, you're sort of relaxed, your mind settled, you're still kind of content, and then suddenly you realise, well, it's not even a realisation, suddenly there's no counting, there's no stages, there's just breathing, there's just breath. And maybe there's not just your breath, but maybe there's everybody, you're getting a real sense of everybody's breathing. Maybe you don't even realise that you sort of forget your body. Suddenly you're not even aware of your sitting and your posture. Suddenly you're just deeply connected with breath, with even life. And then you think, and then the bell goes. And then you wonder what happened. And the same with the metta bhavana. You can be trying to bring somebody to mind, focus on them, not get distracted, all of that kind of stuff, but then you relax and you open, and something opens up. And you can stay with that person or whoever it is. And suddenly, again, you're not even focused on an individual person. Perhaps you find yourself really connected to fragility, the preciousness of life, how fragile life is. And you feel it for that person, but you also feel it for yourself. Or you feel it, you even realise it's not personal to you, it's not personal to anyone else, it actually permeates the whole of life. And maybe tears come. And then the bell goes. But there's something of that that stays with you. In fact, when those experiences happen, you can't just get up and go get a cup of tea. You have to sort of stay with it. Something's happened. So in a way, this is what happens to Shantideva, practicing the Manjushri visualization practice. He's there practicing, and suddenly Manjushri is there before him. He's in touch with the presence of transcendental wisdom. And it has a deep effect on him. So, these sort of experiences, and it doesn't just happen in meditation either, actually. It can happen wherever. You can be in nature, and suddenly you're feeling there's a deep connection with the tree. And you think, this tree's alive. and you really want to communicate with the tree. So it can happen in all kinds of settings. It doesn't have to happen in meditation. But obviously meditation sort of is very conducive to that, because you're relaxing your mind. And you're relaxing your ordinary mind, let's say. Your ordinary mind that likes to, that is very fixed on how things are. Normally your ordinary mind decides whatever, you know, who you are, who other people are, what's happening. It makes judgments all the time, and it fixes things all the time. But with meditation, your that ordinary mind can relax, and something else can come into being. So, yes, and actually what comes into being is a deeper experience of you, actually, and of the world and of reality. That's what comes into being. So I call it the ordinary mind, and I'm very familiar with my ordinary mind. It's lived with me for a long time, but I also know I have a mind of faith, and mind of love, if you like, that really will cut through all the barriers that I set up and create. And in a way, meditation gives me that opportunity to access that. But we can lose, so we have those experiences, and those, if you call it a visionary experience perhaps, or just a spiritual experience, and it can be huge to the point that you really are affected, and you know, it takes you some time to sort of almost reintegrate sort of your ordinary way of thinking. Or it can be in the course of a meditation practice or a retreat. But those experiences can fade as well. So in a way, if you have those experiences, it's really important what we do with them. It's very important what we do with them. Sometimes it can be that we think, oh, that's it. I've seen the light, you know. I've seen how things are. And we want to hold on to that experience. And then when we sit to meditate again and we can't get that experience again, it's very frustrating and disappointing. But that causes suffering, actually. So sometimes we want to hold on to it, and other times the experience we want, our ordinary mind wants to make sense of it, wants to sort of rationalise it. And sometimes it wants to push it away. Because in a way, when you have an experience like that, well, what does it mean? What does it mean for you? What does it mean for your everyday? What does it mean for your life? What's the implication of that for you? So it's actually quite challenging, actually, when those things happen, because it's sort of pointing you somewhere, but you don't always know where it's pointing you to. So what I say, in a way, is those experiences are kind of like that they're seeds. They're seeds that, when the conditions are right, will flower. So all we have to do is not sort of worry about them so much, but just sort of recognise that those keep practicing, and recognise that when the conditions are right, something else will come into being. Yes, that will flower that experience, or it will make sense to you, or start having much more of an effect in your sort of everyday life. Yeah. So we've just got to keep practicing. So Manjushri, not Manjushri, Shantideva has this experience when he's given this practice as a young man, and we don't know what happens in the intervening years. He goes back to his ordinary life, and he's waiting to be throned as the next king. Well, not waiting, but that's what he's destined to do. And his father dies, and he's due to take the throne. And we don't know how many years it is between that experience he had as a young man and him waiting to be king. But it happens, at least he's ready. On the eve of this coronation, he goes to bed and dreams of Manjushri again. And this time Manjushri appears and speaks to him and says various things, but one of the things he says is, I'm your teacher. And I think at this point that Manjushri realised that, Shantideva realises that, you know, it's not going to go away. This sort of this seed, this something he's seen way before has arisen again, and it means something. And he has to now take some action. He can't just ignore it again. He has to take some action. And I was thinking about this in terms of people's, our progress, that it does take time for us to take action sometimes. I don't know how it was in terms of you coming to the Buddhist Center, whether that was an instant thought and then you arrived, or going on retreat, whether it's an instant thought, I'm going to go on retreat, and then you went. For most people, it takes quite a few goes, quite a few encouragements, you know, or right now I need to go to the Buddhist Center, or I need to go on retreat, or whatever the action is. It's not an instant thing. So this is what happened to Shantideva. It took him a while to take on the fact that he needed to take action. But he does, and actually he leaves the palace, just like Siddhartha the Buddha, he leaves the palace. And the next bit of his story is that he finds himself, or he seeks out other practitioners, and finds himself at Nalanda University, which was this huge monastery where they had hundreds of teachers apparently, and thousands, was it thousands of students? Thousands of monks. Can you imagine that? I can't imagine that. I think it's amazing. So he finds himself there, and he's, I think by this time, again, we don't know the how many years were intervening, but by this time, I think he's spiritually quite very developed. He seems to practice, he has a teacher, but he seems to practice mostly by himself. And he's practicing, but the other monks, because he's not following what all the other monks are doing, so they're working really hard. Yeah, they're really consciously making a lot of effort. They're studying, they're practicing, they're doing pujas, they're doing all of the things you're supposed to do, debating with each other. But Shantideva is just lying around. He's lying in bed. He goes to get his food, and they start getting really annoyed with him because they're like, look at us working really hard here. We're making loads of effort, and there's this guy who's just lolling around, without a care in the world. He just eats, sleeps, and goes to the toilet. And he shouldn't be here. What's he doing here? So they get quite annoyed with him. And it's quite interesting, I think, this sort of they're really working hard, and then you've got this the Shantideva who just seems to be enjoying himself, relaxing, yeah. But actually, he is practicing, but his way of practice is one of, now on this level, he's one of receptivity, I think. He's just receiving teachings. That's the level he's got to. But they don't sort of see that. And I was thinking, in a way, Subhadra Mahatir was saying this earlier when we were meditating, that there's two ways of cultivating metta. You can make effort, you can do all the things that we tell you to do, with the kind of saying the words and imagining people in lovely places, and feeling sort of connected to them, or you can tune into what's already there. You can relax into the love that's already there. In a way, we can make conscious effort in the way that the monks are making conscious effort, or we can tune into and be receptive to the kind of loving heart that we have intrinsically. So I think this sort of divide between Shantideva, if you like, and the monk sort of represents that on some level. We actually need to do both. We can't, at our level of growth, we will have to make effort. We will have to say the phrases with the metta bhavana. We will have to bring our minds back with the mindfulness of breathing. That's what we'll have to do. And at the same time, we also have to allow space for something to arise, something to come into being. And we can do that in lots of different ways. So that's what Shantideva's doing. He is being receptive to the wisdom that's already part of his experience. So I was thinking about this because about a year, almost a year and a half ago, I was in Spain. I was at an ordination retreat in the mountains in Spain. And I was chanting the mantra, well, I was about to chant the mantra, I lead the mantra, and I thought, I'm going to lead this mantra really well. I'm going to really go for it. I sort of really want it to have an effect. So that was me consciously making an effort, yeah? And so there I was, the mantra was happening. And I did feel very connected with it. And suddenly something happened. It was no longer me chanting the mantra. Something else was chanting the mantra, and I was carried along with it. And that was fine. It was like, that's fine. I felt a deep level of contentment and groundedness and connection with well. In a way, I wasn't experiencing, me chanting the mantra anymore, making an effort. It was very much, there was just mantra. There was just Amitabha's love that I was part of. And it was very grounding, very, I could use, it's hard to describe these experiences, but I could say it was a sublime type of experience. And then it was fine, and like, it sort of ended. And later on, I thought, what happened there? And I couldn't sort of make sense of it. And sometimes it can be quite unnerving, actually. I couldn't make sense of it. But again, in a way, it's kind of what the retreat had been doing was, there was a lot of concentrated energy on that retreat. So we were all sort of making this sort of conscious effort. And at the same time, there was lots of space. It's a place where there's a huge expanse of space, so you're looking at blue sky, you know, all the time, really, and it's very, very beautiful. So in a way, you had this focus and you had this space, and that's kind of what we need in our practice. We need sort of focus, but we also need to give ourselves space, and something will happen. The kind of mind of faith will appear. So Shantideva, back to him, he's enjoying himself, communicating and being receptive to the teachings, and the monks are getting annoyed with him because they're not making the same level of effort. He's not making the same level of effort they think that he is. So they decide to teach him a lesson. And they decide they're going to do that by getting him to teach. They're going to set everybody up to do a teach to the whole assembly. And they think he's not going to know what to teach because, you know, he's not even been to class, so how can he know? So they actually really set him up. So when it's his turn, they build this huge throne out in the fields to the point where he can't get up on the throne by himself. He's going to have to get help to get up there. And they're really waiting for him to fail, really. They want him to have major humiliation. So they all go out ready for him, but they're surprised because there he is already on the throne. So that's already confused them. How has he got there? And then they say, well, now you need to teach. So he's like, well, I don't know what to teach. What is it you want me to teach? And they're like, no, you just got to teach. So I said, well, do you want something original, or do you want something, you know, standard teaching, or something new? Something new, something original. And he does teach, and he teaches the whole of the Bodhicharya Vatara. Well, he recites it, and there. Astounded, of course. They've never heard the words before. The whole text takes them through a series of moods, a series of spiritual experiences that can only come from your direct experience and from deep observation of yourself and others, deep understanding of mind and heart. And so he's teaching. And, well, in a way, what happens to them, I think, is that they're no longer thinking, oh, come on, show us what you can do. They now are in the teaching with Shantideva. They're receiving from him. And apparently, at some point, Manjushri, of course, appears to Shantideva. But not only does it appear to him, it also appears to many other people, not all of them, but many of the other monks in the assembly. So he's been able to communicate the Dharma in a way that other people have had their own direct experience of it, and left their ordinary mind and gone into sort of, I guess, experience universal mind. So this has obviously a huge effect on them. And I was thinking about, well, in a way, that is the mark of a bodhisattva, somebody who is orientated towards enlightenment. Their communication has a deep effect on you. Their practice has a deep effect on you. You get drawn in, if you like, by their practice, and it makes you want to cultivate your own qualities. They can't do it for you. No one can do it for you. It's your experience, your mind, your life, But they can show you the way to the point that you sort of intuitively know your next steps, if you like. So that's what Shantideva does to the assembly. In a way, we're benefiting from Shantideva. Not only are we reciting the sevenfold puja and really getting a glimpse of at least seven of those moods, seven of those qualities, seven of the phases that he talks about in that book. In a way, you can also say this centre has come from, has been, Shantideva has contributed, let's say, to this centre arising. Our teacher, Bhante Sangharachita, I know the Bodhicharya, but this book, this text, is certainly a key text for him. He's compiled the puja from this text. His teachers, who inspired him, this has also been a key text for them. So you could say that the Bodhisattva, the Shantideva, the Bodhisattva, has inspired really many generations of teachers, including the teachers that founded this centre. And now we have got the opportunity to be inspired as well by the mind in the 8th century. So our puja. So yes, this theme is about puja. And seven phases. And Jnanavacha, for the first three weeks, spoke about a few of those phases. So I'm just going to just recap that. Actually, I'll tell you the little how it ended. The story ends magically, of course, because you know, they're in the crowd. He's taught them, and Shantideva rises in the skies and disappears. That's the end. So the sevenfold puja starts with worship, and with worship, that what that's saying is you need some values. We need vision. We need values. We need ideals that move us, that we want to move towards. There's lots of conflicting values in the world. Yeah, there's lots and lots of conflicting values in the world. It's very important for us to feel like we've got a meaningful life, that we're making the most of this one life that we know we have, when we're relatively able to take in the Dharma, that we can ascertain the values that are most important and precious to us that will help us grow. And this is what the centre is about. But finding your vision, your values, your ideals, that's the first stage, really, of the puja, worship section. And salutation, the next stage, salutation, is where we know our values, but there's a gap between where we are and our values. We're not living out our values every day. We know that about ourselves. We want to, we know it's important, but we're not doing it all the time. So salutation really says the more you respect, the more you pay attention to your values, the more you pay reverence to your values, the more you'll move towards them. So that stage of the puja is helping us do that, really sort of appreciate and pay respect and even reverence towards our values. So now we know our values, we do want to move towards it, and then we get to the phase of the third stage. The third mood in the puja is going for refuge. And in the going for refuge section, we're basically taking action. We're making a commitment. We're saying it's not just about thinking about it, we've got to do something. We've got to actually look at ourselves, look at how we behave, how we interact with other people, what's our communication like, how we treat ourselves, what goes on in our minds, and we have to take responsibility for that and take some action. And that's where, in this stage, we also have the precepts, the ethical precepts, where you're moving away from actions that cause you and others harm, and you're moving towards actions that actually increase your well-being and that of others. So that's the third stage of the puja. And the fourth stage you had last week, which was the confession section. And in that section, as we're practicing the precepts, as we're becoming more aware of the effects of our actions on ourselves and others, We are learning about ourselves, we're discovering things, things are arising, and maybe we realise that we can harm others. We can harm others and we are harming ourselves. And we sincerely don't want to do that. We know what our vision is, you see. By this time, we know what our vision is. We want to move towards it, and we can see the barriers getting in our way. So we want to do something about that. So in that fourth stage, we confess. We acknowledge our shortcomings, and we sort of dedicate ourselves, rededicate ourselves to doing something about that. So that's the confession section. And we say right at the end in the puja, something like we won't do it again or something. In a way, we kind of know we might, but we're still kind of saying it anyway, because each time we affirm that in ourselves, it strengthens it. So even if you find yourself, you know, sort of acting unskillfully again, keep confessing, keep doing the puja, keep sharing your acknowledgement with someone you can, your shortcomings with someone you can trust, because each time you do that, it strengthens your resolve. And it also gives you insight into the behaviour, what's going on. So then we come to where we are at now, which is the fifth mood, which is rejoicing in merit. And in a way, once you've sort of let go of some shortcomings, you feel a bit lighter. You feel like, you know what, I can do this. It's not easy to grow. It's not easy to work with your unskillful states of mind. It's not easy to hold a vision and values in your mind. But you realise you can do it. You are doing it. And that makes you feel positive about yourself. But also, really importantly, you begin to see positivity in other people as well. You begin to see other people's qualities. You want to grow, and you want to see others grow too. And when you see that, you appreciate it. So the next phase is appreciation. You appreciate how hard it can be to grow, how challenging it is. So when you see it, you really want to acknowledge it. So all of these phases in the puja, it's poetic, we practice it together, but they're also very practical things you can actually do. We can rejoice in other people's qualities. We can say what we appreciate about somebody. I did it on the phone today to HMRC. they was explaining something really complicated, and I was like, I don't really understand, can you say it again? And she had to keep explaining it again and again. And I was like, I think I'm getting there. And I was like saying to her, is this what you mean? She was like, yes. So we're sort of arriving at this sort of common truth together, common understanding together. Well, for me, really, because I really wasn't understanding at the beginning. And usually it's a conversation like that. You're sort of relieved at the end and you think, okay, all right, thanks a lot. And that the phone goes down. But I was like, thank you so much for your patience. That's really helped me. It's a really simple thing, isn't it? But she was a bit like, oh, thank you. We sort of had this mutual thanks on the phone. And it felt really good. It felt like I could leave that conversation knowing that I'd done something positive, even though it would have been quite a sort of a, quite an involved conversation, I'd left her feeling positive. And I felt positive too. So the thing about rejoicing in merit is you share the qualities, you appreciate somebody else's qualities, and you get it back. And I was thinking that rejoicing in merit is a antidote to what we often experience with other people, particularly if somebody's shining, if somebody's really doing very well, and what we normally can experience is envy, of course, or competitiveness, or some kind of arrogance, or we don't even notice because we're so wrapped up in ourselves. So when we rejoice in merits, we're really countering those tendencies. You can confess those tendencies, of course, in the previous stage, and you can also work on the opposite. You can actually just rejoice in others, and it will have an effect over time on those tendencies, those negative tendencies. So it's something we can do. And it's something I feel like I can do more than I do. It's something I benefit from hugely. Working here is a real sort of, and just being around the centre actually, generally coming along. You know, there's always somebody rejoicing in somebody else, and it's a real pleasure. I love just listening to other people rejoicing in each other. I feel I benefit from that as well, because actually when that happens, we're understanding the nature of growth. that's the key thing. It's not really about us. We're sort of affirming our desire to grow. And we're affirming the importance of positive qualities in the world. The world's in a not a great state. So when you see somebody doing something really positive and they're sharing that with someone else, you know, appreciating each other, it's like the world really needs that. So we by even listening to that, and we're benefiting from that. So I'm going to encourage you to rejoice in someone this after you leave this class. Just practice it over the week and see what happens. What we say is, it's not about saying, "Oh yeah, you're great" or "you're lovely." That doesn't really sort of tell us anything about ourselves, does it? I mean, we can, yeah, it's still all right, but we want to know a bit more. So it's actually being as specific as you can about what you observe and see in another, what you appreciate, and also be able to think about, well, how is that benefiting? You know, that person being like that, they're benefiting me, or they're benefiting a situation, or they're benefiting someone else. And if you can reflect on that, that really is, it's so life-affirming, actually. It's a bit like, I was thinking the Dharma's like a plant. Well, we're like plants, and the Dharma's like rain. The teachings are like rain, the practices are like rain. And we sort of do them, and we sort of, they have an effect. But it's quite, it can be quite, you don't always see what effect practice is having on you. All the time. It can be quite imperceptible how we grow. And we can get a bit frustrated that it's not happening fast enough. But if we're practicing, if we're engaged in the teachings, it will be having an effect, just like the rain is having an effect on that plant. But I was thinking the sun, when the sun comes out, you know, when it's really deluge of rain, let's say it's been a bit of a drought, and the plants really soak in the rain. And then when the sun comes out, you see the plant grow. You have that. It's suddenly there's a bud that's opened up overnight because the sun is there. So rejoicing in merit is like that. When you rejoice in somebody, or you're rejoiced in, it's like you suddenly grow right before one's eyes. And you see that on retreat. If you go on retreat, and if you get the chance to be on a team, you know, a really positive team, you'll see that people literally just grow as if before your eyes. So I'm going to encourage you to practice rejoicing in merit. Find somebody that you want to appreciate. It can be, you can be appreciated directly to them, or you can tell somebody else about them. Either way, it's still a positive thing. And I would quite like, so be specific, think about the benefit as well. If you can't think about the benefit, just enjoy it, you know, just sort of enjoy it and reflect that back and see what effect that has on you. Yeah, see what effect it has on you. See what gets in the way as well of you doing that. Because sometimes it makes us feel all uncomfortable, or we think, oh, I'm, you know, whatever. There's a few things that might get in the way. Just notice that. But you don't have to stop. You can notice it, but keep going. I'm wondering if we can have a little practice run now. we're going to have a little practice run just for a couple of minutes each way, in pairs. Just think about somebody now that you can appreciate their qualities. And then I'll ring a bell halfway, and then we'll end. And then we'll recite the mantra, the Amitabha mantra, to conclude the evening. And then next week, we're going to pick up positive emotion again. And we're also going to come to the heart of the puja, the wisdom teaching. We'll introduce that next week. And Nanavarch will pick that up the week after. Okay, so let's get into pairs and just, think of someone that you can appreciate for 2 minutes each way. Yeah.